We are air-breathing landlubbers who live above ground, and that's how we view the world. But in fact, most of life on this planet is underwater or under our feet. Ecologists have long assumed that the capture of energy from sunlight, photosynthesis, is the driving force of ecosystems. But now, biologists have found that the process of decay, the breakdown of organic material, is the real regulator of ecosystems. That work is done by insects, worms, fungi, and microorganisms. Ori Laux is an ecologist at Miami University in southern Ohio. He's one of a vanishing breed. He doesn't just sit in a lab in front of a computer. He's actually out there mucking around in the dirt. He's studying the effects of pollution on forests along the Ohio River. He's been comparing two plots of land, one in southern Illinois where pollution is low, and another in Ohio where pollution is high.
In those soils in southern Illinois, we have 30 earthworms per square meter. That's rich. You know, you can get all the bait you need to go fishing in 15 minutes. On the same soil, these soils were matched very identically, and they have the same kind of forest, white oak, black oak, and hickory on it. The same soils in southern Ohio have one earthworm per square meter, and it's a species that lives in dead wood. All of the earthworms that live in soil are gone.
This is an earth-shattering finding, because it's not just worms. It's all the other things in the soil as well. Almost half the biodiversity is gone from soils that are the richest on the North American continent. And you can see the effects. The trees are dying. Ori Laux.
The death and decline in growth that we observe in that forest is attributable to the failure of function in the ecosystem, and that failure, we believe, is due to the loss of biological diversity. We've lost half of the numbers of individuals, and we've lost half of the species. And so we have to ask the question, at what point in species impoverishment did ecosystem function become so impaired that we destroyed the capacity of the trees to grow or to process litter? In other words, every aspect of that system, you know, beginning from the soils and then spreading to the functioning of the larger species and to the birds that feed in the litter layer, every aspect is now dysfunctional. And does that dysfunction start at 20% of loss of biodiversity or 10%?
The only honest answer is we don't know. We have no idea how much biodiversity can be lost before an ecosystem collapses.
Human observation tends to be directed at events that are big and dramatic. And so changes that take place among little organisms over long periods have been just generally discounted. And there's only a relatively small audience out there that are able to say, earthworms are king. Now, this is where the action is.
We already know we're exterminating elephants and rhinos and whales and other big species at catastrophic rates. But this story about the earthworms in the forests of Ohio is far more chilling. Death, or rather decay, is taking a holiday. And simply put, if we don't have death and decay, we won't have birth and life. In September of 1991, eight people were sealed into a giant bubble in the middle of the Arizona desert. It was called Biosphere 2, and it was meant to recreate the Earth's natural systems. It housed different ecosystems like desert, ocean, grasslands, and tropical forest. 3,800 different plant and animal species were collected and set up inside. It was an attempt to create an airtight, self-sustaining system that would eventually make long voyages in space possible. It was a miniature version of Biosphere 1, the Earth, and it was supposed to provide the clean air, water, and food needed to support the Bionauts over 2 years. It was, you might say, the arc of technology. As an ecologist, Gretchen Daly had a keen interest in how it all turned out.
$200 million went into creating a tiny little self-contained ecosystem in which 8 people were hoping to live for a period of 2 years. So this little area, it's down in Arizona, it's about maybe 3 or 4 acres in area, and it's got a little ocean, it's got croplands, it's got rivers, it's got all kinds of stuff in there that would, in theory, help purify waste and all that stuff, perform all these services. And yet the people that went into this found that even with heroic efforts, they couldn't keep it going. Rapidly, the oxygen levels plummeted because of activities of some of the soil organisms I told you about. And so the oxygen level went down to what you'd find at over 17,000 feet in elevation, so they're nearly going hypoxic in there. Then nitrous oxide levels skyrocketed to a level at which function of the brain can be impaired or actually severely damaged. All kinds of things happened. All of the pollinators went extinct, and many of the species they had put in there went extinct, thereby dooming most of the plant species to eventual extinction. The water had to be purified by hand because none of the natural purification systems that they thought they had designed in there were working. And all sorts of other things happened. Cockroaches and katydids and these crazy ants lost their minds and took over. Vines grew out of control, so people had to spend a huge amount of time just cutting back and trying to control the organisms that took advantage of this situation and the lack of natural controls on their activities. So what that shows you is, you know, most of these services are so complex, they operate on such large scales, and they're so little explored that we can hope to replace them with technology.
In a way, this was a successful experiment because it proved we don't have any idea how to create an environment that supports us like the one we already get for free. As we tear at that fabric of life, we like to think that human ingenuity will always make up for our destructiveness. So far, we're not even close. Gretchen Daly.
It is humbling. I mean, it makes you laugh. It shows, I don't know, some of the good sides of humanity, you could say, our curiosity, our determination. And in many ways, those are, we would think of them as noble qualities. I mean, they're interesting things, but at the same time, we're like little kids. You know, we've amassed this power, and we've deceived ourselves somewhat. I mean, in modern urban societies today, and in the most, basically the richest and most powerful parts of the world, people are so removed from these ecosystem services that they've basically all but faded from view.
Biosphere 2 tells a story that's humbling. It ought to make us reassess a great deal of what we do. But in the last 200 years, science and technology have worked wonders. People used to die far younger. We lost about half our children. And think of all the things we have now. Television, cars, computers, and satellites. It does seem like science and technology can do anything. Why can't it save biodiversity as well? E.O. Wilson.
Many people cling to the forlorn hope that science can rescue biodiversity even if humanity continues to wipe out the natural environment. Say, the notion being that, well, go ahead and clear cut the last of the forest for that little extra bit of agricultural land. You know, go ahead and dam that river, even if it's going to wipe out all of the crustacean and most of the fish species above the dam and so on. Let science take care of that. I mean, after all, and worse comes to worse, we keep on doing what we're doing, worse comes to worse. The scientists can go out there and they can rescue the species and put them in zoos and gardens, and they can freeze them in and liquid nitrogen and reconstitute, you know, like reconstituting eggs from a powder later on. And let me tell you what the truth is. The truth is that science hasn't got a clue. Science can't take care that way of more than a minute fraction. Consider that there are 40,000, 50,000 land vertebrates, for example, mammals and reptiles and amphibians and so on. And all the zoos of the world can only take care, even if all their forces were mobilized to take care of endangered species, only something like 4,000 species on a solid and continuing basis. And those zoos have no facilities whatsoever for looking after the millions of insect species, crustaceans, numerous other invertebrates that are vital to the life of ecosystems. Where are they going to go? No one has even thought about saving them in that manner. And it gets at least as bad in the botanical gardens because they are ill-equipped to look after the 250,000 species of wild plants out there, a large fraction of which are threatened or soon will be. And what about all those microorganisms that make up the soil and are vital for the sustaining of the base of the whole ecosystem? We don't even know what those microorganisms are, more than 99% of them. Now, people go on and say, well, okay, suppose they do become extinct and we can't rescue them. We can surely someday, if we have their DNA, reconstitute them and make the species again. Forget it. It may be possible with some living species to someday, with their DNA, bring an organism back to life. Maybe. But only a minute fraction could be done that way. And even, let me make it even grimmer, even if we could do it, which we can't, but even if we could bring all the species back to life, we don't know enough about the ecosystems to know how to put the ecosystems back together. You know, what combinations of species and what order and so on. It would be like unscrambling an egg blindfolded with a spoon. If we think we can eliminate those natural ecosystems and substitute prosthetic devices to keep the planet in that delicately balanced, highly peculiar state on which humanity depends in its physiology for its life, then we are kidding ourselves. An ecosystem, in other words, the system that gives us all those services, all that stability, that security, the cushion for free, it's there, it doesn't cost us anything, is a system of complexity far beyond the capacity of supercomputers with the best scientific minds in the world to even get down correctly and abstract, much less create from scratch. So for a few centuries, ladies and gentlemen, the wise thing for humanity to do is to settle down before it wrecks the planet and to save as much of our natural ecosystems and species as we can to carry us through the tough times coming in the 21st century.
About three centuries ago, Newton and Descartes pictured the universe as a giant machine, a clockwork mechanism. Ever since then, scientists have concentrated on identifying and separating the different parts of whatever phenomenon they were studying. That means analyzing complex systems by reducing them to their most simple components, like taking a clock apart to see how it works. This approach is called reductionism. Now, however, there's a new breed of scientist who looks for systems and patterns that are usually missed when things are broken down. For example, physicists have found that when subatomic particles are combined, new properties emerge that can't be predicted from what's known about the individual particles. The whole is more than the sum of its parts. For most of human history, people understood that everything around them, from trees and animals to clouds and the sun, was somehow interconnected. They searched for patterns to explain the mysteries of the world. Modern reductionism pushed aside these old ideas, but now they're coming back. Brian Swim is a mathematician and cosmologist. He believes that science is converging with ancient tradition.
I think that the really thrilling opening for our culture, our planetary culture, is that the deepest discoveries of science have an amazing corroboration with the ancient spiritual insights of our wisdom traditions. Say, take the Buddhist world and the notion of emptiness. The emptiness is something that is full. It's a realm that generates all that is. Well, for 400 years of science, this made utterly no sense whatsoever. But now, in quantum physics, we realize that elementary particles emerge out of the vacuum. And then we actually measured it. And we now know, as an absolute scientific fact, that the basis of reality is emptiness. Now, we say vacuum, or we'll say the quantum vacuum, or zero-point energy. All of these are simply words that scientists have used to point to a very mysterious reality. It's a reality that doesn't consist of things. It is actually a reality that consists of power to give birth to everything. So our actual understanding now of the universe from its physical dimension corresponds very deeply with these ancient understandings in Buddhism and Hinduism concerned with emptiness. The most viable scientific hypothesis of the birth of the universe is that the universe emerges out of the vacuum. And this sounds very similar to traditional understanding of Atman, Shunyata, or in the Christian tradition it would be the Godhead, or sometimes theologians would talk about the super essential darkness of God. Well, that's another way of referring to a realm that scientists are pointing to with the word quantum vacuum, or just vacuum.
One of the most remarkable new theories to come out of recent scientific discoveries is that the Earth regulates its own systems. The atmosphere, the land, the oceans, and all the living things on Earth somehow interact to keep conditions stable over long periods of time. Brian Swim.
One easy way of capturing this is simply to say the Earth is alive. Of course, the Earth is not alive the way a salamander is. It doesn't give birth to baby Earths. So the word live here is used in an analogous way. It's alive in the sense that it actually organizes itself so the complexity of its life forms might continue. One easy way of seeing this is that the life forms require a particular spectrum of temperature for the molecules to operate. And the Earth maintains itself in that range that enables life to come forth. And the reason we know that Earth is actually maintaining itself is that the output of the sun has changed drastically over billions of years. It was 25% less intense in the beginnings of life. And so life had to alter the clouds and so forth to trap the heat to keep the Earth at a particular temperature. I mean, it's another stunning realization, because you can't perceive the Earth as self-regulating in our own local frame of reference. It took all of this data brought together, and suddenly we captured a sense of the whole. Now, intuitively, this was something understood by indigenous peoples for 10,000 years, 50,000 years, maybe. And without question, indigenous peoples knew the Earth, they thought of the Earth as Mother Earth and alive. I'm simply saying that 400 years of science has enabled us to begin to approach this more intuitive truth from an outer or empirical way. So that, taken together with indigenous knowledge, again, we have the opportunity for a stronger understanding of the self-regulatory or living nature of Earth. And so we begin to see ourselves not as just individuals on the planet Earth, but rather as sentient creatures that are within the actual organized life of Earth. We're a part within the whole. And this perspective is, I think, very different from what we've been used to, at least in modern industrial culture.
Brian Swim thinks the discoveries of quantum physics may finally give our wandering tribes a mythos to help us join back up with each other and with all the other creatures who share the planet with us.
Where science helps here a little bit is that we now see that we are actually kin to every species. By looking at the molecules, by looking at the forms of metabolism, by looking at the genetics, we start to see that we share in with every species. I mean, this recent discovery of a bacteria that deals with oxygen, it breathes, in a certain sense, oxygen. And so its way of dealing with the oxygen is with a molecule, a hemoglobin-like molecule. And so physicists examined the structure of this hemoglobin molecule. And then they looked at the hemoglobin molecule of a whale. Both of these capture oxygen. And when you put these two together on the computer screen, they're almost identical. And the reason they're almost identical is that they both have a common ancestor around 3 billion years ago. So that it's not that we're imposing a relationship upon the world. We say, well, we have to develop a bond with all creatures. It's that we are discovering, actually, at the level of consciousness, what's actually there in the very structure of the beings. The whale and the bacteria are cousins, and we're all cousins. And so I would say that the interrelatedness is there. So it's not a question of straining to feel concern for the creatures. It's rather the question of how do we activate an awareness of the deep bond that already exists. That's the challenge.
Most of us take as an article of faith that science provides us with a precise picture of reality. But at the cutting edge of human thought in modern physics, we don't find absolute certainty. We find uncertainty and relativity. Depending on how we look at light, it may be a particle or a wave. Matter appears from and disappears into nothingness. Time expands or shrinks. Speed depends on where you are when measuring it. It's a bizarre cosmos. It would be the height of arrogance to believe science has made most of the important discoveries about how the world really works. Science has only been in existence for a couple of centuries. But for hundreds and thousands of years, our predecessors, indistinguishable from us physically or intellectually, were wondering about the cosmic unknown, the vast forces impinging on their lives. There were countless Einsteins and Curies among them, and their dreams and insights were handed down through their oral traditions all over the globe. Indigenous knowledge has been tested by the most critical condition of all, survival. It had to work, or those early theorists wouldn't have left anyone to pass it on. Seen in this way, we in the industrialized urban societies have much to gain from other perspectives. Jeanette Armstrong is from the Okanagan Nation in the interior of British Columbia. She directs Anaukan, a native-run educational center. And she's obviously thought a lot about her people's understanding of who we are and how we fit into the planet.
Physically, we are the land, we are the air, and we are the things that surround us. The eating of the foods of the land, the beings that give their lives of this great compassion and this great love for life in every way, gave their bodies to us and gave their lives to us for our continuance, as we give our lives back, you know, to the land for its continuance. So one of the things that we as Okanagan people know is that our very flesh is our land. Our very breath that we take is our land. Everything that is about us is our land. And in seeing that and in knowing that, we understand that we have the same natural ability as the land to be whatever the land is. And so when we call on our spirits in the spirit world, that's how we talk to them, is that the most foundational word when we refer to everything is we only have one word, meaning everything, the land, the water, the birds, the insects, everything, including ourselves, we say Tmich. And that means everything, including us, has that life force in it. We're the same as everything else. Only our form changes because everything has to reveal itself in a different form so that this wonderful creation can be.
Most of us live in the human-created and human-dominated environment of cities. Nature is something out there. Nature is a resource filled with commodities for us to exploit. As in the rest of the world, the ancient Okanagan landscape is being dismantled. Our old-growth forests are melting like snow. The creatures embedded in them, like the grizzlies, salmon, birds, and snakes, are vanishing too. Jeanette Armstrong's life has spanned the traditional world of her people and industrial society.
I can go back to my memories with my grandmother and my grandfather and my different aunts and my brothers and sisters. I remember going out on the land with them. And going out onto the land was, it was like being with members of the family in a way. And I never understood that until later when I started looking at what that meant. When my grandmother would say, grandmother, you know, and name the lake, or grandfather and name the mountain, or these grandfather trees, and talk to the wildlife that way. I never used to see the differentiation between human beings and the life forms around us. And when those grandmothers or grandfather mountains or lakes or rivers or streams are destroyed, it's like your grandparents being hurt, you know. For our people, no different than a family member leaving. And it's that connection at that level. And it's more than just an emotional regard for the land or emotional maybe love of the land because of its pictorial quality or its beauty. It's an actual relationship with our land in that way. And that relationship is generations long. It's not just an individual. And I can't see how life could be without that. You know, and that, as I see, is the most fundamental different perspective. In that kind of principle, in that kind of attitude, you can't go out and destroy that land. You no more than you, unless you're insane, no more than you could destroy your grandparents, you know.
I come from a very different world than Jeanette Armstrong. I'm a scientist by training, and as a scientist, I've also come to realize that we are inextricably bound up in the web of living things. We all share our DNA. We are all genetic relatives, created by the air, water, soil, and sunlight around us. When we look at the world this way, the environment is no longer something out there. It literally is inseparable from us. It is us.
David Suzuki from Naked Ape to Super Species. And finally, the conclusion of Charles Eisenstein's 2006 book, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and the Convergence of Crises Birthing the Transition at Play Beside the Tower. In the reduction of reality to number and name, in the program of owning and controlling the world, we have wrought a Tower of Babel seeking with our finite tools to take the infinite by storm. To do this, we have so specialized and separated, and so reduced and exhausted the world, that the coherency of the vast mega-machine that makes possible our ascent to the heavens is threatened. Our tools of control are insufficient to manage the chaos we have unleashed. Our ascent, even the illusion of our ascent, slows to a standstill as the effort to merely hold everything together grows to consume all resources. Now, as the tower totters under its own weight, now, as each attempt to share up its crumbling sections adds to the instability of the whole edifice, perhaps we can see more clearly, from amid the ruins of our civilization, what the collective purpose that we have yearned for might be. The supreme irony of our Babelian quest of attaining the infinite through finite means is that we are actually enacting precisely the opposite. We are liquidating all that is infinite, sacred, and unique, converting it into the finite, the controlled, the generic, standard, and measurable. To think of redwood forests reduced to furniture, possessions, and ultimately to money, numbers in a computer. We are cashing in the earth, selling off our lives, reducing reality to data. Soon, there will be nothing left to convert, as all social, cultural, natural, and spiritual capital is exhausted. The tower totters and sways. Once proudly leading the vanguard in a glorious conquest of nature, science, and technology, the whole regime of management and control are now consumed in an ever more desperate attempt to simply hold things together. Having cut ourselves off from nature, from wholeness, and therefore from health, we try frantically to manage the consequences with one technological fix after another. Like an addict trying to hold his life together, we shift debts, create rationalizations, and generate long-term consequences to solve short-term problems, pretending all the while that everything is under control. Science will find the solution, we think, as we manage problems by putting them off until a future day of reckoning. Like the addict's increasingly unmanageable life, such an effort is destined eventually to collapse completely, bringing us face to face with the realization that we can only recover, only heal, by relinquishing the entire mindset of control implicit in existing systems of technology, science, medicine, money, property, and education. At that point, we will be open to the healing power of nature, the wild, the inherent purposefulness of the universe, the beneficence and fecundity of something beyond rational understanding and control, something greater than ourselves as we have conceived them. On one level, this means remodeling our industrial, social, educational, and economic processes after those of nature, replacing the metaphor of the machine or computer with that of the ecosystem, where there is no such thing as waste that is not also food, no place that is external, where there is no centralized organization, where each part is dependent on all others, where the most successful are those who best fulfill their function in meeting the needs of the whole. More than that, nature can also bestow upon us a model of creativity that does not entail the reduction of life and world. I have long felt that the disappointments of the environmental movement stem from its failure to articulate anything more positive than sustainability. The creative gifts of humanity, culture, and technology, having enabled us to destroy so much, are understandably seen as an errant scourge that must be reined in. Can the gift be separated from the curse? I asked in the introduction. Does the salvation of humanity lie in the denial of the very essence of our species? My heart says no, but for a long time I could see no other option. Now, finally, I can envision a more than sustainable future that accommodates the exuberant expression of the gifts that make us human. Like the indigenous artist who understood his work to be the revealing of the form already contained within the carving block, we can see ourselves collectively as an agent of nature's continuing self-revelation. We will no longer impose, but discover and reveal. To get back to nature doesn't mean passivity, to desist in the effort of creativity. We are creative beings made in, quote, the image, it is said, of the Creator, part of nature, which is nothing less than creativity itself. No longer need we see nature as the passive and inert substrate of an external creator's art, nor as the empty, arbitrary result of random interactions of forces. Reflecting upon nature as it really is, endlessly creative of new forms and systems of beauty, we will understand that our highest purpose is to actualize unmanifest realms of beauty too. Indeed, we have been doing this for millennia already. In addition to ruin, technology has afforded us new modes of creative expression that would have been unimaginable just a few centuries ago. The difference is that soon it will become our conscious collective purpose. The forces that today pressure us to sell out will disappear along with the illusion of separateness that gives them rise. In their place, new forces of the civilization of reunion will arise, which will reward wholeness, beauty, sustainability, discovery, and art. Freed from the anxiety inherent in the manage and control mentality, we will also be free to create beauty rather than to sacrifice it to the apparent necessity of survival. The human gifts that have empowered us to bring the planet to the brink of catastrophe are not intrinsically evil, demonic powers to be spurned, but are in the end sacred means to take the creation of beauty to a new level. The problem is that we have not respected them as sacred. We have prostituted our gifts. We have been stuck in the delusion that their purpose is to gain us comfort, security, and pleasure, which follows from the idea that there is no purpose to life but to survive, which follows from our deeply held Newtonian ontology, which itself is just the culminating articulation of separation. When I say the purpose of technology is to take nature and the creation of beauty to the next level, I do not echo the common view that now that technology has essentially solved the problem of survival, it is time to halt the destructive spiral of materialism and turn our attention to art, music, literature, pure science, and aesthetic enjoyments. In other words, it is time to retire. This view goes back at least to the age of coal, when the terrible suffering of industrial laborers was justified on the grounds that it was a temporary sacrifice necessary to usher in the golden age of plenty. Now the thinking goes, it is here, or at least it could be here, if only we weren't so greedy, if only we didn't spend $1 trillion on weapons, if only the economic system weren't so skewed. This view ignores the fact that there never was a problem of survival. The age of plenty is not the fruit of technology. It is technology that has led us away from plenty to a world of anxiety, scarcity, and alienation. But if the misconception of self and world that has driven our technology were to change, its function as a force for separation would change as well. The creation of beauty I speak of is not limited to the traditional aesthetic arts, which, isolated in their museums, have become a category largely separate from life. Every industrial process, every social institution, every relationship of our lives is a suitable object of our art. Humanity's turning to art is not the hobby of a retiree. It is the fusion of life and art, art and work, work and play. Instead of focusing on survival, making a living, our interaction with the world will be our play. After all, our purpose is to understand, appreciate, and participate in nature's ongoing creation of new realms of beauty. And how do we do that? It is through play. Isn't that how a child learns to understand, appreciate, and participate in the world? In a sense, the entire course of separation has been nothing but a cosmic play. The difference will be that we will no longer be lost in the game, no longer oblivious to the illusory nature of our separation. With this consciousness, our play will become again playful. The parallel with storyteller consciousness described in Chapter 7 is significant, and in fact, play and storytelling are deeply connected. Play is an enactment of a story, a provisional reality with its own rules and agreements. As we become conscious creators of our stories, so also we become conscious players in the cosmic game. All the accoutrements of the separate human realm, label and number, images and machines, technology and culture become our playthings and the instruments of our art. No longer unconsciously lost in that separate human realm, we are free to unite it with the natural. We reunite its linearity with the rest of the cycle from which we tried to separate it. We reunite its symbols and stories with our conscious creative intentions. We reunite its technology with the purposes and processes of nature. Wielding our gifts consciously now, we can create a human realm no longer at odds with the natural. To reunite with nature, to reconceive self and the world may sound like an unachievable ideal, but actually it is closer than close, as available at any instant as nature is herself. A Chinese proverb goes, as far away as the horizon, yet right in front of your face. On the one hand, no matter how far we travel, we can no longer find pristine, perfectly undisturbed nature anywhere on this planet. There is no escape from the sounds, the chemicals, the lights, and all the other signatures of technology. All ecosystems are disturbed. Moreover, we take ourselves, our thoughts, and our being with us anywhere we go, and by our very presence as sojourners from civilization, adulterate the purity of our destination. Like the horizon in the proverb, pristine nature recedes as we approach it. On the other hand, nature is also right in front of our face, in us, and all around us. It only recedes as we approach it, when we conceive it as something separate from ourselves. We could, I suppose, attempt the reunion of the human and natural realms by willfully abandoning technology and returning to the Stone Age, but I suspect that the yearned-for state of purity would recede before us like the horizon in the proverb. The origins of separation go back beyond the Stone Age. Shall we overthrow the dictatorship of the eukaryotes? Fortunately, it is unnecessary. A return to nature, as the proverb implies, is as easy as a shift of perception. I will conclude this book by offering a few thoughts on how to reunite the human and natural realms on the individual level. Going back to nature can be as simple as crawling on your hands and knees for a few minutes, sniffing the dandelions. The healing power of even this tiny action is amazing. No matter how doubtful you are, however reason denies it, sniffing the dandelions just for the experience of it, watching a bug just to see what it does, looking at the clouds for 5 minutes will have a noticeable effect. As Tom Brown Jr. put it, a 5-minute walk through a vacant lot or the park will have regenerating qualities about it. They'll be able to see more and feel more and therefore realize their aliveness, close quote. It seems trite, but even the most conventional ways of reconnecting to nature can erode the illusion of separateness, which is so much easier to maintain in the boxes of our houses, cars, and computers. Nature is also in our bodies. The Cartesian mind-body split, which located the self apart from the body, can be healed through various practices that render the split experientially absurd. Yoga, Tai Chi, martial arts, the Feldenkrais method, authentic movement, contact improv, the continuum, and various hands-on healing modalities can reveal to us that body is an aspect of mind, and mind is an aspect of body. But is signing up for a yoga class or taking more walks in the park going to heal the planet? Obviously not. Except that, imperceptibly at first, such minor changes begin to erode the illusions of separation. The process of reunion on a personal level often starts with a persistent disquiet before it erupts into a full-blown convergence of crises. It is the sense that something about life and the world is just not right, and this feeling alone can constitute a crisis in the sensitive. One's job, one's plans, one's way of life doesn't make sense anymore in light of a dawning truth. Eventually, all aspects of life undergo a thorough transformation. Many books on our environmental and social crisis offer nothing but despair, either in the form of these problems are too vast for you to do anything about, or in the form of tepid palliative suggestions like buying green products and recycling your beer cans. In a way, the despair is justified. Everyone knows that even if you reduce your ecological footprint to zero, your individual action is as nothing compared to the colossal forces that are inexorably destroying our planet. A life that makes sense in the full realization of the tragedy of the human condition cannot be achieved by switching brands or buying a Zen meditation kit. Eventually, we realize that the transformation must reach the pith of life, core issues of relationship and work. By degrees, spiritual realizations take on a material character. The despair comes from realizing that life as we know it cannot go on. If this realization is unconscious, no matter, the unconscious mind will engineer crises that propel birth into a new state of life. In this core transformation, we tap into a power that makes the aforementioned despair irrelevant. It comes again from a return to nature, but on a much more subtle and profound level than the beginning steps of reconnecting with the body and the outdoors. It parallels a primary theme of this book, which is the transformation, rather than the abandonment of the separate human realm, so that it is no longer unnatural. On the individual level, it comes through the power of word, storyteller consciousness, living in the gift. These are what enables us to realize our full potential as world-creating beings. It is no coincidence that these concepts contain within themselves nearly all the world's great spiritual teachings. Non-attachment, love, opening to something beyond our separate selves. More than in the outdoors or the body, nature is in these things. Living in the gift, rejoining the gift circle of ecology, in which purpose lies in the fulfillment of our role and function in an ever-blossoming, ever-transforming whole. Storyteller consciousness, assuming a conscious role in the universe's ongoing play of self-creation. Not only does going back to nature free us from the chains of survival anxiety and teach us our purpose as creators of beauty, that is, artists, it also teaches us how best that beauty might be created. By observing the grand pattern greater than anything the manufactured and artificially separated self could contrive, we become aware of the unique role we have to play in that pattern. This understanding comes from the simple fact that we are part of the pattern. It is not distinct from us. By observing nature, we observe ourselves. By learning about nature, we learn about ourselves. The function of I, this provisionally self-aware part of the pattern, becomes apparent. Sooner or later, whether driven by a crisis from within or without, the normal lives we have known are going to end. The mad scramble of technology and self-improvement seeks to continually find ways to maintain normalcy just a little longer. What is seldom recognized is that normality is at the root of the problem and contains the seeds of its own demise. It can be maintained only with constant and growing suffering, the very suffering that now consumes our world. Seldom acknowledged as well is that normality, even if it were sustainable, is not worth sustaining. We have grown accustomed to enormously impoverished lives, yet a buried memory remains of what life can be and should be, a memory sometimes brought to the surface in those lucid moments of joy and connection I described in the introduction. I speak to this memory and this knowing. I wish to remind myself and everyone that a far more beautiful world and life is possible, and that this possibility demands a revolution in human beingness. The call is urgent. Live a life that makes sense in light of all the truths you are awakening to. The social and planetary crisis, the illusion of separation, the impermanence of your discrete and separate self, the futility of the program of infinite control, the robbery of our spiritual capital, the reduction of the world to money, the sell-off of time and life, and for what? All we can do, and all we need do, is to live a life that makes sense. The danger is that even after seeing these truths, we continue to pursue an illusion anyway. Old habits are hard to change. A saying goes, "The truth will set you free." Nothing more is needed. Nothing less will suffice. The eons of striving to transcend human nature are over. Now we are learning we need only come more fully into what we are. Part of the coming to wholeness that I have described as the Age of Reunion is to no longer hide away parts of the world and parts of ourselves whose existence makes life as usual inconvenient. We will not heal our hurting planet, nor will we help any living soul by denying ourselves. Quite the opposite. Our true nature denied, separation from who we are, is what has caused our present crisis to begin with. For centuries, the message has been to be less, to overcome human nature with self-discipline, just as we overcome the rest of nature with technology. But today, the conception of self and world, upon which the ideology of control is founded, is obsolete. The war on nature and human nature is over. It is time to step into what we truly are, and so assume our divine purpose in nature's evolution to its next level of beauty. Herein lies the self-acceptance and self-trust with which I opened this chapter. These do not lead to the destructive, narrow greed of the discrete and separate self, because this is not really who we are. Ultimately, it is a path of self-love that will necessarily bring us back into love with the world. This path is not without its pain. Indeed, it encompasses all the pain that there is. But on the other side of the pain and sadness is understanding, wholeness, and therefore freedom. By integrating the sad truth of what we have made of life and the world, the sad truth of our millennia-long reduction of reality into label and number, money and property, we regain a vision of what we can be, should be, and actually are. We reclaim our birthright as whole creative beings, in love with life and life in love with us. The infinity we seek is here already. And it always has been. The collapse of the tower, the world under control, the quest for certainty in science is laying bare the fraud that has enslaved us for 10,000 years. Yet we must remember that this fraud too has its purpose. We must remember the playful origins of separation. This exploratory game we have lost ourselves in and from which we are now awakening. Our quest, our journey to the farthest reaches of separation is now nearly complete. However hard the birthing pains, a light beckons us, a reunion with that place of enchantment, understanding, and wholeness. Let that light sustain us through the coming darkness. And that is the conclusion of the book, The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises, Birthing the Transition, published in 2006 by Charles Eisenstein, and can be found at ascentofhumanity.com. This is the conclusion of the book, but not of the issues it raises. Thank you for listening. Or should I say, thank you for thinking.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will all